You are listening to the Accents podcast on WUKY. I am your host, Katerina Stoikova, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. My guest today is poet Bill Verbal, who has a brilliant book just came out, so I wanted to talk to him. Hi, Bill. Welcome to Accents.
Hi, Katerina. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on the publication of your first collection of poetry, Absence Descending. Tell us the story of this book.
So the story with this book, I had just some various poems that I had written. I guess, gosh, this was 3 years ago now. I signed up to participate in the poetry boot camp that you lead, and looking for feedback on poems and how to start to assemble a collection. And I think when I signed up, I wasn't even really sure if I had a collection, but as I started to pull poems together, I saw a theme in the things that I was writing, just around change and loss, and from there began to shape this collection, and seeing some opportunities to kind of fill in some spots as well, and so wrote some poems that ended up being part of the final manuscript as well.
And who picked it up?
It was published, picked up by Broadstone Books, which is just a wonderful press based in Frankfurt. But they publish poets from all over. And I submitted it as part of their open reading period in 2024. And the publisher, Larry Moore, told me that mine was literally the last manuscript that came in during that open reading period. So I got it in just under the wire, and I was excited to find out a little while later that they had accepted it for publication.
Well, that should tell our listeners that even if you're submitting on the last day, you still have a chance.
Yes, absolutely. Last day is still within the time period.
So, can you please read several poems for us?
I'll start with a poem that is one of the earliest in the collection. I first wrote this probably about 7 years ago or so, and it's kind of a tribute to my next door neighbor, who is a wonderful man, and the title is Clematis and Forsythia, and it's dedicated to Garland. Your clematis still snakes up from the ground, a clotting knot of vines taking grip of the forsythia on my side, wrapping its spindly limbs to make one woolly green mass, swallowing the low fence. It grows as it did when we idled our mowers, letting minutes slip by, chatting about the seeping heat or the wind whipping your morning walk. With a slight smile, you floated dry quips, landing like finches on a telephone wire. The butter yellow petals of flowering forsythia still sprout in spring's warming and melt in a day's time. You had the patience to wait for white crosses of clematis to spread at summer's end, draping the fence like a bride's veil. Life surrenders in winter, making way for life. I watch it flower without your soft greeting. The peonies still sag under their fat blossoms. The crabapple blooms still puff like cotton. Since we are fairly close to New Year's, this is a New Year's poem titled Morning New Year's Day. The glass slips and shatters in the sink, slicing my hand, still in a mist grip, drops forming red suns. We leave ourselves stunned when we carry on in two worlds. Even dreams can draw blood. Shards glisten, making blades brightened in the light of the young year. We enter the ritual of renewal, gathering what's broken, carrying what's incomplete.
I'm so glad that you read this one. I would have requested it if you hadn't read it. Can I make a couple of requests myself right now?
Absolutely.
Okay, so one of them is back early in the book, earlier in the book, and it is about Mrs. Benson.
Yes. Yes. This one is kind of a narrative poem. It's telling a story. The title is At the Lexington Public Library Searching. Mrs. Benson next door tells the story more than once of her prize-winning quilt. Last one I made for 20 years. I got busy raising kids. She can't remember the year, just that it made the paper. I wish I did more. I did pretty good with it. When she passes, I decide to honor her kindness across our fence. At the downtown library, I stop in the rotunda to watch the giant pendulum swing, anchored on a slim steel wire, plumb bob like a worn Christmas ornament, sweeping across the mosaic map, seconds ticking in silence. While scanning microfilm of the Morning Herald, I wonder if I'll find the memento of pride I'm seeking. Urgent stories past blur by. And the image sets in my mind, a beaming young wife in front of her star-laden quilt, holding up a ribbon big as a bloom. 64 of them, she'd say each time, every star different. 9 months, at least an hour a day, as pretty as a Sunday morning in first place. She'd laugh, then shake her head. My daughter lost it in one of her moves, and I didn't keep that copy of the paper. On a reel from 1959, I find a Sunday feature recounting the horses, pigs, and pies on display, listing winners from Lexington with a postage stamp picture. Young Mrs. Benson, standing prim. The th same thin smile and eager eyes, her quilt cloaked in background shadows, holding up a ribbon embossed, third place. I stare at the screen. My cheeks flush. I take the reel back to the desk and decide to keep the story of her quilt as she told it, stitched with unspoken desire. Leaving, I stop again to watch the pendulum, reaching, always reaching.
I loved it. I loved that story about someone wanting to present themselves in a certain way and somebody wanting to honor them. But finally, just honoring a secret could be the best way to honor someone.
Yeah. We all have our own fish tales, you know, of the big catch, maybe exaggerated. And it's that was kind of the seed for this particular poem.
I would love to hear the last jar.
All right, the last jar. So the last jar is part of a series of poems in the second section of the book that are rooted in my growing up and spending time on my grandmother's farm. This poem and some of the others kind of get to the different experience that I had spending time on the farm versus the life that my father had growing up on the farm. The last jar. We left for last the dusty cellar, its weak yellow bulb tossing shadows as we removed ball jars from the dumb waiter shelf. Dad held one up. Ah, Mama's pickles. He stared at the jar. The last of your granny's pickles. He sighed and set it aside in a separate box. Dad chafed against the life of growing up on the farm, even when his bitter words left Granny in quiet lament. Dad kept peace at her dinner table, praising the spread provided, proclaiming the virtues of her pecan pie. The pickles sat in Dad's pantry. Then a year later, maybe two, I noticed the jar was gone and realized there was a moment of his own choosing when Dad savored the sweetness of the last pickle in a final private funeral.
I find this so moving, about someone who decides when and how to have a closure. And I can imagine, what's great about this poem is also what's being unsaid. And I can imagine how this ceremony took place, almost as if taking a communion.
Right. Yeah, and but also very individual and not, just part of the private mourning as opposed to the, more familial or collective mourning.
What does your family think of your book?
Oh, they're very supportive. The poems that my that feature my father in the section about my grandmother and he's enjoyed those poems. So it's been a lot of very warm support for the book and excitement that it was accepted for publication, and then now that it's published.
Talk about writing elegies.
Writing elegies. There is like one poem in the book that is titled Elegy to Abby, which was and Abby was a cat, and she was the first cat I had, really my first family member of my own family, when she passed on, as we all have our pets do, years later, I wrote the poem just thinking about her and what she meant to me. It's it, and I think elegies, they capture the things that still resonate of the thing or person that the elegy is about. Because I think there can be elegies not just about people or pets. There can be elegies to places. There can be elegies to ideas, even elegies to our past selves in terms of who we might have been as a child or some at some time earlier in our life. And so it's in writing the elegy to Abby, I tried not to be too sentimental, but to really capture the personality and character of this cat, but also what we meant to each other.
I read a lot of those poems in the book as elegies of sorts, especially the poems about the grandmother.
Yes. And I didn't, it's interesting you point that out, because I didn't necessarily think of them as elegies, but they really are, because there are a lot of the poems in that section that, and kind of like with The Last Jar, where it kind of focuses on this jar of pickles. A lot of the poems focus on objects, but they are objects that have meaning in part because of the people who touch those objects, or created those. So the jar of pickles was that was my grandmother made pickles, and so it wasn't just a jar of pickles. It was for my dad. It was mama's pickles. And that's one of the things that I really find interesting, and just find that the way that we carry people forward is in the objects and the things that they, that were part of their lives.
You do have quite a few poems about objects that are left after people and what they mean, what these objects mean to the people who are left. And would you mind reading the poem Inheritance?
Yes. Inheritance. Dad took the mantel clock. I bundled off the scuffed armoire into a house already full. On the bookcase, I stuck the white-lidded pot, one of those for sparing a midnight sprint to the outhouse. I also made space in the basement for boxes of items, not so much bequeathed, but left behind. Bound homilies fitting in the palm, yellowed accounts of harvest transactions, and pocket watches keeping time still. Looking through greeting cards postmarked 100 years ago, I do not know if they were kept with longing or duty. Granny's pause to discard passes to me like a gene. These items are a ring I can't slip off my finger. Things needing to be let go, heavy with the burden of forgetting.
Wow, so beautiful. How does it feel to have completed this project?
It feels great. It really does. There was a time when I put this aside, wasn't sure that I was going to complete it, and it was probably put aside for about 3 or 4 months, and then I decided, it's I'm going to complete it. I'm going to refine the poems that need to be refined, and spent probably a good 4 or 5 months on that refinement, and pulling some poems out and maybe writing a couple to put in. Even when I first submitted it for consideration, I didn't necessarily think it was complete at that point, that it's if it weren't accepted, then I may continue to work on it. And so, at some point, I think there's a saying about how poets never really finish a poem. They just, pause in the revision and with this, I recognize that this, the manuscript that became this book is, it represents who I was, where I was with the work that I was doing, at that particular time. And, one thing, because there was a good probably year plus between when it was accepted and when it was getting ready for publication. And one of the things that felt re really good, because during that year or so, I had put it aside and hadn't read it, and then when I picked it up to read it again, before needing to make sure that everything was good for publication, I still enjoyed it. And it's like, okay, good, I still like all these poems. So that it's felt real good to get it out and to have folks respond positively to it.
Tell us about the cover image.
Oh, the I love the story of the cover, because the cover was one of the last things that the Broadstone, the publisher, worked on. There was a an idea that they had presented that I was like, well, let's see what else we can do. And so we kind of went back and forth and talked about, like some sort of image of a cemetery, and that the designer would maybe go to like the Lexington Cemetery, someplace like that, to see if there was anything that could be found for inspiration. And I suggested another cemetery that the designer, and her name's Ashley Johnson, that she check out, because one of the poems is about a small cemetery that's right next to a busy road. And so I suggested, I said, if she wants, maybe check that out. And so she did, and saw, because this is an old cemetery, and it's kind of fenced off. It's very small, but somebody has gone in and put, some flowers and like a small statue of an angel, kind of like you would see for someone that had passed more recently. And she took some pictures and used that and did just a beautiful rendering of that. So the cover, shows these flowers and this angel figure, but the angel figure is looking away. You kind of see the back, and I just love it that it came from one of the locations where one of the poems is based.
That's such a great story indeed. Novelist Margaret Wirbel, whom I like very much, she was your second mother. What does she think of your poems?
She has it's been interesting, because she told me that she was gonna read a poem a day from the book, and there've been several times that she has texted me and said, "Hey, I read this poem. This poem is just fantastic." And that always feels great. So she's been very very supportive of it.
Speaking of famous Kentucky writers, you have studied with a couple of legendary ones, such as Guy Davenport and Jane Gentry. What were they like?
Yeah, as an undergraduate at UK, and I studied English, did take some courses with Jane Gentry, and she was wonderful. She was just so kind. I recall, 'cause she taught one of my classes my freshman year, and a couple of friends and I just enjoyed her class so much and were so inspired by her that we got her a small gift. We went and got a book and gave that to her as a token of our appreciation. And then later on, she was the advisor for the JAR, which was the literary magazine for the honors program at the time. I'm not sure if they still do that or not. And so I spent a year on the staff of JAR and thoroughly enjoyed her. Guy Davenport, I had several classes with him, and he's one of those professors and teachers that you're there to listen to, and I say that in the most positive way, because you are going to hear just some amazing thoughts and ideas. I just his the way he put things together, and just his scholarly background, I just learned so much from him, and it was one of the highlights of from when I was an undergraduate, taking courses with him. Those kinds of professors and teachers are one of the great joys we can have, as students.
And speak about your time at WRFL. I love that place. You probably know that Accent started there as a radio show in 2009.
I was got involved with WRFL as an undergraduate, and this was just after they had gone on the air. I think I first started getting involved about a year after they had gone on the air. That was being involved with RFL was a big part of my education, just because of the people that I got to know, the things that they were into, just connected with a lot of amazing music, and just had the opportunity to being a DJ and just kind of putting together a show was always fun. Getting to learn just lots and lots of different music, and there are a lot of those folks I still keep up with in some form or fashion today. It was really at that time, and it was really a magical place, and just it's always great to see things going on now at RFL, and what the students there are doing with the radio station.
Whoever has ever been involved with WRFL always says that the place has left a very strong mark on them. That's what I've noticed. It did.
Yes.
It did change my life too.
Yeah.
One of the biggest tragedies of the pandemic was that WRFL lost the claim of having a live DJ continuously 24/7 for 20 some years, right?
Yeah.
And then we lost that. But it is what it is. It's about changes, just like your book, changes
Yes.
and loss and moving on. And speaking about organizations that change people's lives, tell us about Kentucky State Poetry Society.
Kentucky State Poetry Society, KSPS, is it's a wonderful organization. I've gotten to know so many wonderful poets through KSPS. I started participating, I think it was during actually during the pandemic, like in 2020, when I first attended the conference, which was all online at that time. And then a few years after that, a friend of mine, Kathleen Gregg, who had been the treasurer, asked me, hey, would you be interested in being treasurer? And at the time, I was not sure about it, just because I had had some more difficult experiences being involved with a nonprofit. And but it was like, okay, I think this is going to be different. And so I said, yep, I could do that. And so I was nominated and elected treasurer. And so that got me involved with the running of KSPS with other board members and talking about ideas of things that we do. And it's one of those things where what we've seen with the pandemic and so much being online, and so a lot of the KSPS activities really ramped up to be online, which is fantastic for an organization that has a mission throughout the state of Kentucky, because it really gives a lot more opportunity for folks all over the state to be involved in the organization. There're just so many things that we do with KSPS. There are monthly readings that we do. We sponsor a student contest, a couple of adult poetry contests. We have a wonderful journal, Pegasus, and we also do an annual conference each year, and bring in folks to lead workshop sessions or participate in panels, or it really is a wonderful engine for poetry in the state. And it's always great to see people excited about it, and to see people attending the open mics or the featured readers, and I may only know them through the little box on Zoom, but it's always great to see folks at that time. And so I would encourage anyone interested in poetry, and in not even necessarily writing poetry. It's not just for people who are wanting to write poetry, but if you enjoy it and you want to hear poetry, then KSPS is a great great organization. And we just and Katarina, I know you know this, we just have so many just fantastic poets in the state of Kentucky. We really do. People just writing real interesting stuff. And it's it getting those people involved in KSPS is always something that when we find somebody, it's like, oh, hey, would you like to come read with KSPS or do something? People are always excited and interested in being involved.
I loved how you described that KSPS is an engine for poetry in the state. And yes, that's how I see it as well. And I think that we do have something very special with our state and our literary organizations. There is more than one organization that is serving the state's literary characters and types, and helping us creatives feel at home and encouraged. And it is so important for every kind of human being, to feel at home and
Yes.
feel safe and seen and appreciated. Because out there in the real world, I don't know how appreciated it is that, hey, I wrote a poem today.
Yes.
But there are people who would absolutely rejoice and applaud that that has happened. And we need to be in the same room with those people, even if we see each other through a little square.
Yes, absolutely.
What are you working on these days? That's my last question.
I've got some poems that I've written. I've written a few things here and there. Where I'm kind of exploring right now is, and I'm not really sure where I'm going with this, but just exploring is examining the workplace as a site for poetry, or the inspiration for poetry. It's and there are several reasons why this interests me. My professional background is in human resources. And so, I deal with a lot of, of course, workplace matters. Part of what I've done is worked with leaders on leadership development. I'm a certified coach, and so I work with individuals that are looking to build their leadership skills. The thing that is important for me with poetry is bringing out the emotion. We have a lot of emotion in our workplaces. We bring a lot of emotion. There a lot in a lot of ways we maybe try to pretend it's like, well, that's work. And then I go home, and that's where my real life happens. But there's a lot that we experience, and a lot of the ways that emotion informs things in the workplace, and you don't really see a lot of poetry about it. The poet David White has written a little bit about it. I recently read a volume by another work Broadstone poet named Marilyn Gahant. It titled A Work Life, which kind of focuses on people undergoing job loss and the journey of looking for other work. I've been toying around with some things like that, try to get to that tension that comes up in the workplace.
Interesting, you should say that we bring a lot of emotions to work. Yes, I think so, but we also bring our childhood traumas, our family issues, the boss is daddy or mommy, and all that dynamic plays out. And sometimes
Yes.
we put expectations to the workplace that we have no business expecting there from that environment, and that
Yeah.
complicates something that should be a whole lot more transactional and simple.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you think of other art forms. There are certainly plenty of movies that are based in the workplace, novels, of course, shows like The Office, a play like Glenn Ross. But I've not run across a lot of poetry that is situated in the workplace.
I've got some. I'm working
You've
on
got some.
it.
Well, I'd love to see it.
Well, let's see who finishes the project first. That's
Oh,
ultimately what happens.
okay.
Hey, Bill, thank you so much. Thank you for talking to me about your book. Thank you for finishing that book. Thank you for all your service at the workplace, and thank you all the ser about all your service at KSPS. Our listeners may or may not know that I'm the current president of the Kentucky State Poetry Society, and let me tell you that we, Vice President Deidre White, and I, and the rest of the board, and the good people who serve, well, we wouldn't be able to do it without Bill. Bill is our rock. Thank you, Bill.
Well, thank you very much. And Katarina, I appreciate you having me on the podcast, and it's always a joy to talk with you.
Thank you.